WOSU Public Media podcasts are made possible thanks to listener support. All of our digital content, such as Snully Goster and the All Sides of the Ann Fisher podcast, depend on the generosity of listeners like you. You can give at WOSU.org or through the WOSU mobile app. And thanks.
Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. According to data collected by Bloomberg News, more than 380 million doses of the COVID-19 vaccine have been given in the U.S. Still, cases of breakthrough infections and the potential for long COVID concern the medical profession. Now, a large British study published in the Lancet Infectious Diseases Journal provides more evidence that the Pfizer, Moderna, and AstraZeneca vaccines are strong protection against getting sick from the disease. The study was co-authored by Dr. Rose Penfold, clinical fellow and geriatrician at King's College London. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Anne. Thank you for inviting me on today.
You know, it feels like forever, but we haven't been living with COVID-19 for that long, for very long at all, when it comes to studying it as a disease. What were the challenges in conducting this study?
Yeah, I mean, it's an excellent question. And I think we've seen a sort of unprecedented rate of research during the COVID-19 era. This particular study uses participants of the COVID symptom study app. And these are participants who regularly log their symptoms using an app to get real-time data collection on their symptoms related to COVID-19 infection. I think is what one of the things you alluded to. I think basically, you know, collecting and analyzing the data in a timely way in order to inform policy, which is happening rapidly on the ground, is really difficult, but also critical if we're going to continue to change the course of the pandemic, both here in the UK and globally.
What about long COVID? Some people call it the persistent. I'm seeing persistent symptoms, COVID, long haul COVID. There's all kinds of euphemisms for the fact that it doesn't go away and that there are weird conditions that come from the disease. Is there anything else like it out there? Like I'm thinking of malaria or something that recurs or has ongoing problems.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an excellent question. And as you say, COVID-19 is a relatively new disease for us. So looking at the persistent symptoms related to it is quite challenging because we've just had a very short time frame so far. I think when we talk about long COVID, it's a very difficult condition to characterize because it presents in many different ways. And I think as part of our study, we saw a huge variety of different presentations. So some primarily respiratory, persistent shortness of breath, cough, some fatigue, which is actually the most common symptom reported here in the UK. Other more cognitive related changes, so persistent memory loss or brain fog, and also people experiencing cardiovascular or other symptoms as well. So trying to sort of characterize it as one syndrome is very difficult. However, there have been other viruses where people have reported prolonged symptoms. Particularly thinking about something like Epstein-Barr virus and links to chronic fatigue syndrome. Whether we're looking at any overlap of the pathophysiology here in long COVID and some of those other post-viral syndromes, I think it's too early to say, but it's certainly important to begin to understand.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I am talking with the co-author of a large British study published in the Lancet Infectious Diseases Journal that provides more evidence that the Pfizer, Moderna, and AstraZeneca vaccines are strong protection against getting sick from the disease. It's Dr. Rose Penfold. She's a clinical fellow and geriatrician at King's College in London. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So there's evidence that the Pfizer, Moderna, and AstraZeneca vaccines are strong protection against getting sick from the disease. Doesn't mean you won't get it or you won't get COVID-19, but that it helps you from getting, keeps you from getting as sick as you might unvaccinated.
Yeah, I think it's an excellent question, Anne, because I think what we're looking at is two things. So all of the evidence, both from the early clinical trials of the vaccine and all of the accumulating real world evidence from many countries around the world suggests that the vaccines do protect against getting COVID-19 infection. And in our particular cohort of users of the COVID symptom study app, we saw a rate of infection of 0.5% in those that had had their first vaccination, 0.2% in those that had their second vaccination, far lower than that of the rates of infection at the time that the study was conducted. So I think it does protect against getting the disease. But I think the important thing that we showed in our study is in those who do contract COVID-19, despite either one or two doses of vaccine, that actually the severity of infection is reduced. So we saw fewer hospitalizations. We saw fewer people presenting with five or more symptoms in the first week of illness, which we've previously shown to be associated with more severe disease. Following vaccination versus matched sort of controlled unvaccinated individuals. And I think one of the first things that we was one of the first studies to show that the rates of long COVID were also reduced, actually approximately halved in those who had received two doses of vaccine who became infected versus unvaccinated individuals who contracted COVID-19. So it seems to be both is the case.
When you refer to at the time of the study, I want to make sure I understand that the Delta variant wasn't afoot at that time, right?
So in the UK, the Delta variant was afoot during the study period.
Okay.
So our study period overlapped with the time when the Alpha variant was the most prevalent here in the UK and the Delta variant. So we were collecting data also during the period where Delta was most common in the UK. I think I should point out our study didn't look at the different variants specifically. Okay. So we weren't able to distinguish between different COVID variants, but Delta was the most prevalent during a large portion of our study period.
You anticipated my next question. So what about the Johnson & Johnson? I don't see any reference to that.
Yeah, that's a good question. So here in the UK, the most commonly used vaccine types were Pfizer and the AstraZeneca. And more recently, the Moderna vaccine also, which have all been approved for use. Johnson & Johnson is not one of the main vaccines that we're using here in the UK. And we were only looking at data from our UK participants of the COVID symptom study app. So we have very little data on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine and whether it's as effective as the vaccine studied in the study.
I know you guys keep track of what each other's doing. Is anybody out there studying the Johnson & Johnson in this regard? Do you know?
It's a good question. And to my knowledge, no.
Okay.
Although I think probably a research group in the US would be best placed to do that, as I understand it's used more commonly out there than perhaps here in the UK or Israel or other settings.
Could you explain how a vaccination, what we know about why a vaccination reduces the impact of something like COVID? How does that work when there's a breakthrough case?
Yeah, absolutely. So obviously, we think that a vaccine helps to boost an individual's own immunogenicity, by which we mean their own immune response to infection. And it's likely in those that are able to mount a greater immune response to infection that they may experience fewer symptoms related to that infection, and also less severe illness as a result of being able to fight the virus better than if they had been unvaccinated. And the interesting thing in our study is we looked at not only at what the disease looks like in those who are vaccinated and get infected, but we also looked at risk factors. And we actually saw that individuals who are frailer and from more deprived backgrounds are more at risk of getting infection. And we know that frail individuals mount less of an immune response. So that's all in keeping with the fact that the vaccine does help to boost immunogenicity.
The frailty makes sense just physiologically.
Yeah.
That it wouldn't be able to mount a defense as readily and as easily and as well.
Yeah.
What about the demographic of underprivileged people? What does that, how do we know about why that might be the case?
Yeah, I think it's an important question to raise both here in the UK and globally. And we've seen higher rates of infection in those from more deprived backgrounds. And that was both in the pre-vaccination era and obviously in our study as well. I think it probably reflects a couple of things. So something about living conditions, more densely populated areas, and perhaps also higher occupational exposures with people from more deprived backgrounds having to go into work and being more heavily exposed to COVID, and also probably lower rates of vaccine uptake in more deprived areas also. And we certainly have some data from the UK that points towards lower rates of uptake in some of these more at-risk groups. So actually, I think our study really emphasises the importance of targeting these groups and ensuring that people are able to access the vaccine from areas of greater deprivation.
The anti-vaccine COVID-19 vaccine movement is a big issue in the United States. How is that playing out in the UK?
I think possibly quite similar to the United States. I think potentially there's less media coverage of it here in the UK, but we do certainly have a lot of people who are against the vaccine or are apathetic or have not got around to getting the vaccine. And I'm actually a clinically practicing general medic and geriatrician here in the UK. And certainly on the medical admissions ward where I work, most of the people we're seeing come through with COVID-19 are those that are unvaccinated, or at least are, you know, within a very close time period of their first vaccine. So I think it certainly is a problem here in the UK. I think many of the infections we're seeing now are in those who are unvaccinated or have only had one dose of vaccine very recently. And I think it's important to emphasise that message to the general public and encourage people to take up the vaccine when they get the opportunity.
What about the idea of a booster? We're kind of getting mixed messages here. What are they talking about there?
I think it's an excellent, very, very timely question as well, because recently the JCVI here, which makes recommendations, has recommended booster vaccinations for more at-risk populations. And that was in the last couple of days that advice has been released. So looking at targeting those who are most at risk of infection and to prioritise those individuals for the booster vaccine. And I think our study, along with others, provide accumulating evidence that some people are more at risk than others of contracting COVID-19 after they've been vaccinated. And it's important to ensure that those people have access to a booster vaccine when it becomes available. So here in the UK, older adults, frail adults, healthcare workers, and those with certain comorbidities will again be prioritised for that.
One issue in the US has been among healthcare workers resisting vaccine mandates. There's a maternity ward in New York City that had to shut down because of worker resistance to vaccine mandates. Is that happening in the UK?
So it's an interesting question because I think a lot of healthcare workers, certainly the uptake has not been higher amongst healthcare workers than in the general population. And in some settings, it's actually been lower than the general population uptake, perhaps reflecting the fact that some healthcare workers think they've already been exposed or already contracted the virus and so don't need the immunogenicity that a vaccination would provide. Here, there has also been talk of having enforced vaccination for healthcare workers, but it's not something that has been brought in as of yet. The main focus is still on encouraging all healthcare workers to ensure that they're fully vaccinated. And in the latest guidance released from the JCBI, it looks like healthcare workers will again be prioritised for a booster vaccine as soon as that's available. And I'm sure there'll be a lot of emphasis on trying to get healthcare workers vaccinated.
Well, what about that issue of previous exposure? What is the evidence that it does protect you as well as a vaccine would, the ones that you've studied, the AstraZeneca, Pfizer and Moderna?
Yeah, so I think the previous infection does seem to provide some immune response or a more augmented immune response to further infection. But I think we can't say that that is better or different or even equivalent to that provided by the vaccine. And I think the important thing to emphasize is even in those who've had COVID-19, getting the vaccine is still the best way to prevent future infections with COVID-19. And also we have an issue here that particularly in the earlier stages of the pandemic, we weren't always testing people. So right. Some people who think they've had COVID-19 may actually have had another seasonal viral illness and actually not be protected or have any immunogenicity against COVID-19 prior to vaccination.
At all, and they shouldn't assume.
Exactly. I shouldn't assume at all. So it's still really important, I think, for everybody to get the vaccination.
Dr. Penfold, thanks for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Anne, for having me on the show. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Rose Penfold is a clinical fellow and geriatrician at King's College London. She is co-author of a large British study published in the Lancet Infectious Diseases Journal. It provides more evidence that the Pfizer, Moderna, and AstraZeneca vaccines are strong protection against getting sick or sicker from the disease. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. In 2019, Burger King began experimenting with a new so-called Impossible Whopper, which looked and tasted like a Whopper, except that it was made from plants. Since then, plant-based products that look and taste like real meat have popped up in delis, grocery stores, and fast food chains, including the donut chain Dunkin', Panda Express, and Pizza Hut. While meat alternatives may please those concerned with better nutrition and the environment, some question whether they truly are healthier. Sally Kuzemchak is a dietitian who blogs at realmomnutrition.com. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. She is the author of the 2018 book, The 101 Healthiest Foods for Kids and Cooking Light Dinnertime Survival Guide. She's an advisor for Parents Magazine and a contributor for WebMD. Welcome back, Sally.
Thanks for having me.
What is plant? We keep calling it plant-based meat. It's not meat. It's plants that are made to appear like and taste like meat, right?
Right. I've heard them called alternative meats or faux meats, plant-based meats. So there are no meats in these meats. They are plant-based products that are made to look and sizzle even and smell and taste like meat.
What's in them?
It depends, but usually the base is what's called a protein isolate. So they isolate the protein from usually soybeans or peas, and that's kind of the base of it. But then they need to add lots of other things to make it look and feel and smell and taste like a burger. So often there is coconut oil that makes them juicy, makes them sizzle, you know, when you put them on the grill. Mm-hmm. There's some kind of thickener like methyl cellulose or something that holds them together in like a patty or a nugget or a sausage link. And then of course they need to look like meat. So they're going to have plant juices, plant extracts, things like beet, paprika to give them that red sort of meaty color. So they're really engineered in a kind of an amazing way to look like meat and to feel like it, you know, when you're biting into it, when you're cooking it.
Have you tried them?
Yeah, I've tried all kinds of them. I've had the sausage and the chicken nuggets and the burgers and the crumbles and kind of everything in between. Yeah, I've tried a lot of them.
And what do you think?
You know, it really depends. I think for people who are trying to go meatless, but really love meat, you know, people who love a good hamburger, people who can't imagine like giving up their chicken nuggets or their chicken patty, I think it's a nice sort of transitional product. If you aren't somebody who loves a burger or, you know, loves hot dogs, for instance, then these may not appeal to you as much. And you may be better off with like a homemade veggie burger, for instance, or something entirely different if you're eating, you know, vegetarian or vegan. So I think it kind of depends on what your goals are and what you like.
So, right. So if your goal is environmental, that you just think that we overeat and we overconsume meat and all that that ensues, that's different than if you're doing it for health reasons.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt about it that these products are better for the planet. So, of course, you're going to have greenhouse gases produced with the packaging. So it was interesting. There's one study that found that the packaging of one of these plant-based burgers actually produced more greenhouse gas than making the burger itself. So there is still, you know, packaging and greenhouse gas involved in that, but it is does not compare to, you know, raising animals for food. Not to say, you know, I eat both, you know, plant-based items and then also meat, but if you're looking at doing it for health reasons, though, that picture is a little murkier. It is not just a black and white, oh, these are necessarily better for you.
And why not? Is that because, like, say, the coconut oil?
Yeah, so the jury's actually still out on coconut oil is a saturated fat, but the jury's still out on whether it is harmful to us potentially to our heart health as other saturated fats are. So, you know, jury's still out on that. But yes, they tend to be high in saturated fat because of all that coconut oil. And when you're looking at all these different ingredients, these protein isolates, these thickeners, these colors, what you end up with is a product that is considered ultra processed. It is a very processed food. It is not like the veggie burgers of the 60s and 70s that you could still make now at home with beans and rice and mushrooms and lentils and things like that. Those are whole food ingredients that you can put together in a patty. These are you know, engineered in a food lab to be a meat-based item or a meat-like item. So it is considered ultra processed. And the problem with ultra processed foods is that they're finding that the more ultra processed foods that we eat, the less healthy we actually are overall, just because there's so little whole food in there. So my advice, if people like these, if they're using them, is just to kind of balance that out with more whole food meals as well. So would I eat these every day? No, I would not recommend that. And the American Institute of Cancer Research actually says, treat these kind of like red meat. So they advise, you know, about 4 times a week, no more than that, just like they advise with red meat, which I thought was really interesting. And 4 times a week may sound like a lot, but for people who are trying to go meatless, they may be using these products. They may do like a breakfast patty at you know, breakfast, and then, you know, veggie burger at lunch, and then something at dinner. So you can see how you could end up with a lot of these like pretty processed foods, you know, in your week.
Because they're trying to replicate or replace the lost animal protein, which is so important.
Right. And I mean, protein is important, but most Americans get plenty of protein. We are not all walking around protein deficient. So you don't have to center a meal. If you're trying to go meatless, you do not have to center it around one of these alternative meats or a faux meat, whatever you want to call them. You can, you know, have a perfectly fine protein rich meal without something like this.
I was wondering about sodium content, because you and I have talked before, and when they're trying to, you know, it's always the sodium and the sugars and the oils that they're always shuffling around so that they can put low sodium on the front of the box or no sugar, but there's something else that they put in instead.
Yeah, so a lot of these products do tend to be high in sodium. And you mentioned the Whopper, yeah. Impossible Whopper. And when you look at that compared to just a regular Whopper, when you're looking at like sodium, fat, calories, it's pretty consistent, you know, with the two. And obviously one is meat and one's meatless. But when you're looking at stats like sodium, it can still be just as high. They can still be just as high in saturated fat, just as high in calories. What they don't have, of course, is cholesterol like meat does, because they come from plants. They don't have cholesterol. Some have a little bit of fiber in them, which is nice. And, you know, they're going to have protein and iron and zinc, which are, you know, good nutrients as well. But, you know, again, it's not a clear like, oh, these are definitely better, because when you're looking at the saturated fat, the sodium, the calories, they can be pretty comparable.
And then if you're like the rest of America, which seems inclined to slap a slice of cheese on top of it, which is just amazing to me how common that is now, you're not doing yourself any favors either.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, I mean, but look at the ingredient list, because you actually can find veggie burgers, or these sort of faux meat looking burgers that have like some actual vegetables in them. Like, look for ingredients like, you know, sweet potato or veggie purees. I've seen some with butternut squash. And so, you know, turn the package over, look at the ingredients, look at the, you know, the saturated fat and sodium, what the percent daily value is. If it's pretty high and you're switching to these because of health reasons, because you want to cut down on saturated fat or sodium, you really need to look at those numbers and pay attention.
And there are some that are kind of like akin to the homemade veggie burger, you know, that from the olden days.
Yeah, am I allowed to say a brand name?
Sure, absolutely.
I'm not supporting them or sponsored by them or anything. Dr. Prager's is actually one that has vegetables in it. And it looks like a burger, you know, it looks like sort of a traditional burger, but it actually has sweet potato squash and veggie purees in it. So I kind of like that one, because I feel like it straddles that, you know, it's more like a whole food burger that you would make at home, but it's convenient.
I wanted to go back to the packaging real quick, because when I've seen them, everything's like vacuum sealed and pretty heavy plastic. Is that what you're talking about as far as the carbon footprint kind of issue?
Yeah. There was a study showing that it produces more greenhouse gas to make that packaging, that, you know, they usually come in like a plastic tray, and then they might have like a cellophane over them, but that produces more greenhouse gas than making the patty itself. So I thought that was kind of interesting.
Cost is a thing. And plant-based is no exception. And that may be a function of the fact that it's so highly processed.
Yeah, I mean, and it's convenient. Anytime you have a convenience food that's in a package, it is going to be, you know, a little more expensive. So you could go to a bulk bin, bulk section of your grocery store and get beans and lentils and rice, and you could go get some fresh mushrooms and make your own veggie burger for really not that much money. But of course, if you're paying someone to make it, and it is sort of engineered like this, there's a lot of advertising behind it, you are going to pay more. So another reason to limit it too is just the cost involved.
Okay, so I'm getting hungry now. Can you give us a quick recipe for a homemade one?
Oh gosh, I don't have one myself, but I could certainly send you some links to a couple that I like.
Okay, maybe we can post that on our Facebook page at All Sides. You know what, the kids are back to school, and we've talked before about food for kids and what you send with them to school if they carry. What are you getting? What are people paying attention to on this score these days?
Well, I am a huge advocate for teaching your kids how to pack their own lunches. So that is sort of my campaign that I'm championing, is to encourage parents to teach their kids to do it themselves with some guidance, and kind of show them what a well-balanced lunchbox looks like. And I even have a little printable you can post in your kitchen to show them, okay, these are sort of the components of a well-balanced lunch, and you can, you know, choose from within these categories, so you don't end up with a kid who has like, you know, a jelly sandwich and pretzels and, you know, chips or something. But I think, you know, teaching kids that sort of independence at a young age is so important, because not only does it take something off of your plate, but it also teaches them, like, how do I assemble a meal that's filling for myself and nutritious and tastes good and works for the, you know, 10 minutes I have at lunch to eat. So I think it's just a good thing for kids to learn early.
So give people an idea of what those components include.
Well, you want some kind of protein source, but that doesn't have to be meat. It could certainly, I have a whole list of 50 non-meat items that you can pack in a lunchbox. So, you know, it could be milk or yogurt or cheese, or it could be edamame is a great source of protein that's plant-based. And then, you know, always good to have fruits and vegetables in your lunchbox, even if it's just a couple baby carrots. Even if your kid only eats like two baby carrots at lunch, they're still having some vegetables, you know, at lunchtime. And, you know, I think a whole grain is a great idea, source of calcium. Calcium is so important as kids are growing up. So those are kind of some of the main components I would recommend. And then you can look and see in your kitchen, like, okay, what fruits do we have that work? What vegetables do we have that work? And make it easy, you know, cut things up at the beginning of the week, or, you know, package things in advance so that kids can just grab it, you know, rinse off your apples at the beginning of the week so you can just grab it. Just make it easy to choose, you know, healthy, whole food, nutritious options.
Did you have your kids at home during the shutdown and everything last year?
I certainly did.
She didn't grimace, people. So what was that? I mean, I'm sure a lot of people were struggling with that whole dynamic suddenly.
You mean in terms of food?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It was, you know, because, you know, I work, my husband worked, we were all home at the same time. The kids were making a lot of their meals themselves. Some of the meals I was like, ooh, not so sure about that one. And some I was like, that's great, you know, but I think that we all learned a lot. And I think they learned to be a little more self-sufficient because I didn't have time every day. My husband didn't have time to go down and make them, you know, lunch. So it was a learning process. I'm happy they're back. I hope they stay. In school.
Well, Sally Kazemchak, thanks so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
That's registered dietitian Sally Kazemchak. She writes the blog Real Mom Nutrition. We'll have a link to that on our website at wosu.org/allsides. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Another flu season is at hand, and public health experts predict it will be worse than last year. We're talking about why that is and how you can minimize your risk of getting the flu amid the pandemic. Dr. Richard Zimmerman is a professor in the Department of Family Medicine at the University of Pittsburgh. Welcome to All Sides.
Well, it's good to be with you. And being a OSU grad.
Oh boy.
I'm glad to be on your station.
Well, welcome. So last year, nobody got sick unless you got COVID. It seemed like everybody was healthy as a horse unless they got COVID-19. That was because of all the distancing and protections that we were using to stop the spread?
Yes. And it was remarkable. In fact, you know, I've been an infectious disease epidemiologist for some time and a physician for several decades, and I have never seen a year like last year. There was essentially no respiratory syncytial virus, which we call RSV. There was no flu in the U.S. and no human metapneumovirus. So with these three common winter respiratory viruses almost vanished. Unfortunately, rhinovirus decided to stick around, so we still got that, but these others didn't. And of course, with a year break, they may come back with a vengeance.
Rhinovirus, why that distinction?
That's a great question. It may be because it is a tough virus and that its makeup is such that it can really survive on surfaces very well and maintain infectious potential longer than the others. So it continued, but the rest of the main three that we think about, the other three, not around. We have seen, at least in my area, and in fact across the country, respiratory syncytial virus, which in Pittsburgh, we're pretty close to Columbus. It was like clockwork. November, RSV starts. We've already seen it this summer. And I'd never seen substantial amounts of RSV in the summer. And that's one of the things that could gives me reason to think we could have a much harder flu. The other reason is we've done some statistical modeling using a couple of different models to see what might happen with no new immunity from flu last year. Would there be a compensatory surge? And our models do predict a 100,000 additional hospitalizations due to flu this year in kind of our base case, and up to another 400,000 additional hospitalizations due to flu this coming year in a worst case.
So when you're talking about 100,000 additional hospitalizations due to flu, that's over last year.
That'd be over what would be a traditional season.
Like 2019 then?
Yes, or 2018 or something, okay. A traditional season.
Is there some sense, I mean, or I'm thinking of it as a, when we talk about RSV or the flu, and worrying about these increases over a traditional season, is that some, what does that tell us about the pent up demand to spread by a virus? Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And whether it's the virus characteristics, mm-hmm. I actually think it's the population immunity.
Okay.
Because as we get out from our last exposure, then immunity slowly resolves and wanes. And so it's actually more of the immunity. We didn't get a chance to have natural immunity boosted in the population.
Okay, because it wasn't spreading.
Right. And international air travel was shut down. So there wasn't, typically we get the virus from either Asia, the Australia, that region of the world, or from across the border from Latin America. And that didn't happen in either case. Again, just a very unusual year. So this one, I think, is going to be worse. You know, we often see 23,000 deaths. I think we're going to see an increase in hospitalizations. Now, there is a piece of good news, and that is that you can get that to go down by increasing vaccination. But just a 1% or 2% increase in the number of people getting vaccinated won't do it. But if we could do something as monumental as a 50% increase in our vaccination rates, then we would offset and could counter this loss of immunity and could counter the surge. And our statistical models show that.
What is typical rates of vaccination for flu?
Well, if you look at all age groups, sadly, we are down closer to 41% as a nation. I wouldn't not have gotten through medical school with a grade of 41%. So it's not great. It's pretty good in young children, and it is fairly good in seniors. But in the adolescent to adults, younger and middle-aged adults, it's not been great.
Are you concerned about both the COVID, you know, and the Delta variant, which is surging now, coupled with flu?
If flu comes early, like RSV is already coming early, then they could overlap. And so you could have a twindemic of Delta and flu. And already we're seeing a little bit of, it would be an overstatement to call it a twindemic, but we are seeing hospitalizations due to RSV. At the same time, we've got a lot of hospitalizations due to COVID. And so we are already seeing that, and you continue to do that, you will strain and potentially go over the surge capacity of the hospitals.
We've talked about RSV in terms of infants. That seems to be a big problem in that demographic. Why is that?
People gain immunity after a couple of exposures to RSV, and so they typically have pretty good protection from natural, because there is no vaccine, from natural immunity once they reach even grade school. Even age 4 to 5, people are often have had 2 infections of RSV and they're pretty immune. There's RSVA and there's an RSV type B. So there are a couple different strains of RSV. There is also, though, as we get older and in seniors, the immunity wanes and the immune system wanes. And so there are also hospitalizations in seniors and in adults who are not in the senior age group, but who have underlying health conditions like diabetes and kidney disease. And so there's hospitalizations in those, we call high risk underlying medical condition groups as well. So we are seeing hospitalizations rise for RSV. And that's the concern. You get a twin. Can't do anything about RSV, but you can do something about flu by flu vaccine.
What is the flu? Short for influenza, right?
Sure. Flu is a virus, and it is a respiratory RNA virus that spread primarily in the respiratory route. And the COVID virus, SARS-CoV-2, is also. And so they have very similar transmission routes. There's, if you ever have seen these great photos, and I already describe on the air, but these great photos of a man coughing where they can take the pictures, you see large droplets. Those large droplets can go about 2 yards and then they hit the ground. But then there's smaller aerosolized particles. Those can go often 4 yards before they disperse. And so both large and small droplets can spread both the COVID virus, SARS-CoV-2, as well as influenza. There are some viruses like measles that are have a lot of these very small viral particles, and they can, in the measles case, stay infectious for hours suspended in the air. Fortunately, for both flu and for COVID, there's not that problem.
They stay suspended. They drop faster.
They drop faster, yes. Not like measles, which could stay, 2-3 hours in the air. That doesn't happen. They go down fairly quickly for both flu and COVID.
There's been this pent up reservoir of RSV that's now out there. Why do you think the flu hasn't responded the same way? It's just it seems like it's sticking to a more typical season.
Well, and thank heavens for that.
Yeah.
The respiratory viruses are often sensitive to changes in ultraviolet radiation and humidity. And so a great time, to transmit them is when people are crowded, like in schools, they're close together. The humidity is different from central heating that dries out the air, and ultraviolet radiation, which can kill viruses, is non-existent or very low because of clouds and the winter sun limits. And so those combination of reasons are the reasons there is spread in the winter for the typical respiratory viruses.
I'm going to take a call here from Teresa in Columbus. You're on the air. Hi, Teresa.
Hi there. I'm calling. I have a 10-week-old, and we're keeping her pretty much on lockdown. She only meets people who are COVID vaccinated, and she hasn't been inside anywhere but the doctor's office. But my question is once we get her out in public and living more of a normal life, whenever that happens, are we putting her at risk of infections for other things because she's not being exposed to anything early in life?
This is a natural experiment. We haven't ever been down this road with the year without the viruses. One of the things that happens with children is that their airways enlarge with time. And so certain diseases can be less of a problem as the airways get better. If you get a decade without exposure to viruses, and we've seen this with somebody who somehow lived in a bubble and didn't get exposed to measles. If you were to get measles as a teenager and never had it in exposure in the times, it can be more severe. But for many of the viruses, a year or two delay is not going to lead to, particularly if they've been infected in the past, a total loss of immunity. And a child who's and I don't remember the exact age, but children who
are not infants, yeah,
will be able to respond well to many of the viruses. They have a strong immune system at those ages. And so generally, I think you can be reassured, but there may be some nasty colds to deal with in the meantime.
Okay, Teresa, thank you for that question. When I got the measles when I was in the second grade 100 years ago, my mom caught them from me, and she got very sick. I was just spotted. She was sick, and I remember that because she couldn't take care of me. Why is that?
The immune system at times can overreact, and we actually see this with COVID. People, we see them, they're sick the first week. They don't feel good. But if they have an immune system surge that second week of COVID illness, they can get very sick because the immune system is attacking not only the virus, but the infected cells and over attacks. And I think the same thing can happen with an adult who's infected with measles, that they have a remarkable fight that they put, but it can go too far. And so measles pneumonia in an adult can be a pretty severe situation. So the it's not usually a secondary bacterial infection. It's usually this immune response that's out of, shall we say, bounds over response.
Given the fears about flu, you know, a twindemic of flu and COVID coming up, and what you've learned, you know, what you've seen so far with RSV, a lot of people, we've already talked about the dismal vaccination rates for against flu in this country. You said it hovers around 41%. You said if you could just get 50% increase over that, it would make a huge difference. So putting it in around 60%. But, you know, you've heard the stories from people over and over again. I took the vaccine, or I got the flu shot and I got sick anyway. Or I didn't get the flu shot and I didn't get sick at all. I've never taken the flu shot. I've never gotten sick. How do you respond to those arguments?
Those are great questions. First of all, let me say I'm vaccinated yearly. My children are vaccinated. My wife is vaccinated. So we walk the talk. Secondly, when they do studies where they inject people with salt water, you know, saline, a placebo, and versus the flu vaccine, the big difference is about 20% of people who get the flu vaccine compared to the salt water shot get a sore arm. So it is clearly true you can get a sore arm, lasts 1 to 2 days and resolves. So that's the side effect that's very clear. For people maybe in their first time of having a vaccine, they might get a little achy, but it's not that common to get achiness. However, if you're in the waiting room of a supermarket or a doctor's office and you haven't been masked, which is the case before COVID, then you could be around somebody else who was sick in that waiting room, be it a pharmacy or be it a doctor's office, and have contracted a common cold virus there. So a inactivated flu vaccine, which is most of the vaccines, the vast majority, inactivated flu vaccine cannot, because it's inactive, cause flu itself. Now, one of the things I want to say for those who would be seniors in your audience, or those who might have chronic underlying medical conditions, like a person with diabetes and kidney problems, is I would think about getting, shall we say, the second generation or enhanced flu vaccines. There are several different brands, so I'm not going to pick any of the particular brands, but there's the older, typically cheapest, egg-based standard dose, and those are fine for healthy adults, healthy teens, healthy children. But for those who are on the upper end of the age spectrum or have these underlying conditions, the second generation vaccines, and the pharmacists and the doctor's offices know which these vaccines, which one they have in stock, they produce a better immune response. And that's what I want for my mom.
Well, why shouldn't we all get second generation or enhanced?
I get second generation, and it's part of it is just the issues of supply and demand.
Okay.
I personally do it, and I actually, for my family, I try to get them the second generation vaccine. So we do that. I also realize some places may not have access to those, but if you have access to second generation, go for it.
You should ask for it. And then real quick, because we're just about running out of time, but there's also the calculation of what flu are going to be circulating, you know, as well, right? So if you get a flu shot for one kind or however many varieties there are, and you get sick, it you may not get as sick. I mean, does it help even if it's not the variety that was targeted by the vaccine?
So in the current U.S. flu vaccines, all of them should be 4-valent. So two against two type A flus and gets two type B flus. It is true that the virus mutates, just like we're seeing the COVID virus mutate with Delta. And if it mutates to a vaccine escape variant, totally escaped, then obviously it wasn't in the vaccine and there won't be much protection. But we're pretty good, not always, but we're pretty good at guessing which strains are going to circulate, and then putting those strains in the vaccine.
Dr. Richard Zimmerman, professor in the Department of Family Medicine at the University of Pittsburgh, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. Wish safety to you and your audience.
Thanks. You as well. Bye. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.